This podcast includes content funded by the British Podcast Award Fund and the Wellcome Trust. Today we speak with Dr. Vanessa Moulton. Vanessa is a psychologist who specialises in mental fitness. She has also worked with Walking with the Wounded, Help for Heroes, Combat Stress, and is the clinical lead on the Future HeadFit project.
My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter and soldier. I run a veteran-owned business, and I'm an ambassador for Lululemon. And it's in these episodes we bring together all of these communities to support society during the COVID-19 pandemic. We speak to experts, friends, and community leaders to talk about best practice, mental fitness, growth, and the facts. This is brought to you by the Declassified Network, and this is Declassified COVID-19.
Vanessa, what is psychology?
It's a very varied topic that I think a lot of people, due to the kind of recent focus in mental health, people kind of believe it's only just started to develop. But, you know, it really has been going for as long as we can remember. But since the 1800s, kind of psychology very much has kind of been identified and worked with. And it's kind of gone through this transition over the years, you know, starting off very much being something that's very separate to our body, something that happens in our brain, and it's very separate. And as time has moved on, we've really started to move towards that kind of understanding and recognition that both our mind and body are connected. And I suppose, you know, a lot of people, when we think about psychology, would focus on Freud and that notion around our mind is all kind of driven by unconscious thoughts. And again, as kind of time has developed through the 70s and 80s, psychologists and theorists started to really focus on the fact that actually, you know, both our conscious and unconscious mind, as well as the things that we do, impact the way that we think and how we feel and how we behave on a day-to-day basis. So psychology, it really has kind of morphed throughout the years, but now has a very kind of integrated approach to our overall well-being, really.
And what are you seeing in the kind of advances of psychology, especially during this period of military psychology, I suppose?
In terms of military psychology, I think with all of it is trying to move more towards really understanding not just the kind of the underlying issues, but very much on a kind of conscious, practical level, what we can all do to contribute towards building and maintaining good psychological health. You know, there has been, and you know, to be honest with you, it's what the field has focused on. We've really focused on kind of mental ill health throughout the last 10 years and how we respond to it, how we create more services, how we create more approaches to be able to treat mental ill health. But what we're now really recognizing, which is fantastic, is that we need to take more of a preventative and proactive approach to our psychological health, and not therefore just focus on when things need treatment, but also what can we do from a proactive perspective to be psychologically well.
So we look at things like mental fitness. This is a term that's been used frequently over the last few years, especially in certain areas. Mm-hmm. What is mental fitness?
I think the best way to try and describe mental fitness, as you say, it's not a brand new thing, but it is quite a new concept for us and in relation to communicating it to the wider world. It's something that several kind of areas like the military and sports actually have really got to grips with the importance of and the benefits of understanding and working with mental fitness. So the best way to kind of describe it, I always say, is to think about our psychological health sitting on a continuum with, let's say, mental ill health at one end and mental fitness at the other end of the continuum. And in a way, if we can kind of relate that exactly as we would do with our physical health, we know now that we have kind of physical, when we're physically unwell, that's at one end of the continuum. And we know that we need to respond and treat ourselves or look for support and treatment when we require support around our physical health. But at the other end of the scale, we know the things that we need to do to keep ourselves physically fit. So, you know, most of us, hopefully, we know to keep active and to eat well and to do all the things that we know that keep us physically fit. And it's this kind of new approach to our psychological health that we really need to help people understand that, you know what, it's not just about waiting until we are feeling mentally unwell to intercept and to either get support or treatment, but to actually do the things that we can do for ourselves, just as we would do with our physical fitness. What can we do to keep mentally fit? Because I tell you, the mental fitness is just as important as our physical fitness. And it's just, it's so, so important that we move towards an understanding around that.
I was asked to do the voiceover work for the upcoming HeadFit project. And in that, I think there's about 22 different elements involved with mental fitness and good mental fitness. We've kind of highlighted 10 today. I have highlighted 10 today that I want to kind of delve into and I think would be most beneficial during this period of in brackets lockdown. The first one I want to touch on is the 15 minute rule. What is it?
The 15 minute rule is probably one of the most basic strategies and tools that we can use, but it's so effective. One of the hardest things with sometimes getting ourselves to do stuff is actually just starting it. Usually once we've started something, we've kind of built up the motivation to actually carry on doing it. When we kind of think about doing something, we think about, maybe it is a gym session or it is about a big chunk of work that we need to do. It sometimes can just feel too much, or we just can't be bothered, or we're just not motivated. But actually, if we break it down into something that's more achievable, like 15 minutes, and also, this is the important bit, you give yourself permission to stop after 15 minutes. So you're not forcing yourself. It's not kind of like a trick that you're saying 15 minutes and then you have to carry on. It is right. Start this for 15 minutes, do it for 15 minutes. And at the end of 15 minutes, you can make a choice whether you want to stop or whether you want to continue. But what that does is it gives us enough motivation just to start something. And that usually is the biggest hurdle when we're feeling demotivated, which is, I know, something that a lot of people will be feeling right now in certain areas of their lives.
And this can be something that is boring to you or you might not like or enjoy doing, but it's like a task that needs to be done. But it can equally be something that you know will be beneficial, like physical exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the point. We can all very kind of rationally recognise that something's going to be good for us, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be motivated to engage with it. So this is just, it's just a very simple way, as I said, of getting over that hurdle, that first kind of the starting hurdle, and get moving on it. Because generally speaking, once we have started something, there is a much greater chance that we will continue past the 15 minutes anyway.
Something that doesn't need 15 minutes but absolutely beneficial when you do it for that period of time is the next thing that I want to talk about, and that is breathing technique. We've discussed with Dr. Walter Busuttil the power of breath and meditation in relation to the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. But can you elaborate why good breathing technique and breathing well is important?
Yeah. So in relation to that kind of that grounding that Dr. Busuttil has given, just to kind of recap on that. So our nervous system is split into two, our parasympathetic nervous system that ramps everything up. And the sympathetic nervous system that ramps everything up and the parasympathetic nervous system that calms everything down. So once we understand that we've got two aspects of our nervous system, what we want to do, especially if we are feeling anxious or feeling slightly agitated, we want to stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system of that full nervous system. So we know that when we do different types of breathing, generally deep breathing, And there's another great breathing tool called 7-11 breathing. 7-11 just simply means you breathe in for 7 and breathe out for 11. Now, the numbers don't necessarily matter too much, but what I'm asking is for you to breathe out for longer than you breathe in. Because what we know is when we breathe out, we are stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system. That is the system that calms us down. So if our out breath is slightly longer than our in breath, we have a greater chance of being able to calm our nervous system down. Now, if we do that for just 2 minutes, that will physiologically impact our nervous system. It's such a powerful one, the 7-11 breathing. And the same with our with just simple deep breathing. When we deep breathe, we are effectively just bringing more oxygenated blood to our parasympathetic nervous system. And so it stimulates this system more when we're doing lovely deep breathing as opposed to short, shallow breathing. And when we feel anxious, we do tend to take shorter, shallower breaths. So actually what we need to do is just very consciously give ourselves little snippets of time during the day to just stop and just do some breathing. That's why I say the 7-11, 2 minutes, do it proactively, do it 2 to 3 times a day, or you can use it when you are feeling slightly agitated and you recognize that your sympathetic nervous system is all a bit ramped up.
I used it this morning. I was about to go on national TV and I was very nervous. And within 2 minutes of just in through the nose, out through the mouth, but really slow and deliberate breathing, just totally calm me down. It was really an example of it in progress.
I have to say, go on. But it is probably one of the only guarantees I give when I'm working with someone, because we know it has an immediate physiological impact on you. There's science behind it.
Next up, body posture.
Yeah. So I love this. I think this is so simple, but every time that we move our body, it changes the brain chemistry and it releases different hormones depending upon the posture that we're in. And these hormones are related to how we feel because they affect your mood. So your body kind of remembers, as does your mind. It's a bank of memories, physically and mentally, around your body posture. So even when you smile, your body is effectively recognizing the muscles it's used before when it's been happy. So it associates those postures, facial expressions and body postures with previous memories and previous moods. You know, we know that things like, for example, standing upright with your shoulders back, you know, which perhaps would be seen as a more kind of positive, powerful position, will increase the hormones that are linked to us feeling more powerful and confident. So we get more testosterone and less cortisol in our body. So it sounds very simple, but it genuinely works. And I think a lot of us, especially when we're kind of feeling anxious, we very naturally kind of tighten up, our shoulders roll down. You know, when we want to lift our mood and to feel more confident, even if it's certain things that we need to tackle during the day, simply getting yourself in a positive, confident body posture will literally scientifically impact your physiology with your hormones, which then affect the way that you feel.
I as you're speaking, then it just reminds me of when I was in a rugby changing room, excuse me, and people start posturing up.
Yeah.
They genuinely start changing, and then you can see people's attitudes start to change because they're going out to almost into like kind of a warrior mode. Yeah. And that's their body posturing.
Yeah.
Another thing that kind of links into that then is positive self-talk. Mm. Why should we, or how should we be using positive self-talk?
The reason why we need to be using positive self-talk, which does link in to one of the later strategies around kind of self-compassion, is our brain struggles to differentiate whether someone else is feeding us information or telling us something, or if we're telling us something. Now, when we receive criticism or negative chat, let's say, this stimulates our threat system. So we have three emotional systems. We have our drive system, which releases dopamine that makes us feel great when we achieve something. We have our soothing system when we stimulate that, which we'll come back to. It makes us feel calm, content, confident and happy and secure. And we have the threat system. A lot of people will know this as the fight or flight system. When this is stimulated and it's ignited and when it's online, this releases all the hormones in our body that makes us feel stressed and anxious, because actually that is how we feel, or how we need to feel physiologically if we're fighting or fleeing. When we are negative with ourselves, so obviously the opposite of positive, we come from a negative stance, we basically turn that threat system on. It views it as a threat. And so our threat system comes on, and then we start to feel anxious. And as soon as we feel anxious, we can't think clearly, we're not focused, and it can really, you know, create a barrier for lots of the different things that we're doing. So positive self-talk, or positive affirmations, let's say, are so important, because what we are doing when we are focusing positive thoughts towards ourselves, we are, instead of turning on the threat system, we start turning the soothing system on. This means that we feel positive, we feel more calm, we feel more secure, and we are much more likely to be able to do the things that we want to do when that system is online. So, as I say, our brain can't differentiate necessarily between somebody else saying something to us and ourselves saying to us. So we do tend to naturally give ourselves quite a hard time. A lot of us are very self-critical.
You link that with breathing technique, that could be even more powerful. The next thing we want to go on to is goal setting. Mm-hmm. And this is what fascinates me, this section, especially when you incorporate good positive habits. But goal setting and how we could use that.
Yeah, goal setting, it is something that potentially a lot of people tend to think is just for the workplace, you know, when you've got your review and, you know, what are my goals? But goal setting is so important just on a day-to-day basis, because what it enables us to do is kind of set more clear direction in terms of what we want to do and how we're going to achieve it. And what this does, why goal setting is important, is once we reach a goal and we achieve something, it stimulates that drive system, which I just talked about, which gives us a lovely big dope of dopamine. And that makes us feel really positive. And then it motivates us to do more positive stuff. So what we tend to do, naturally, we tend to just kind of, we fall into just doing kind of more high level goals, like, you know, I want to get fit, let's say. But actually, if we are more specific in terms of what that actually means, and we break it down into, you know, one of the things that we break it down into a very easy way is kind of a SMART goal. You make it specific. You make it exactly what it, you know, you say you want to get fit. What does that actually mean? Does that mean you want to lose weight? And if so, how much? Does it mean you want to do more burpees in a minute? What does that actually mean? Because then that enables you to actually gain a sense of achievement when you achieve it. Because if you just say, I want to get fit, you're never going to know when you've actually reached that goal or not. So being more specific enables you to understand what your goal actually is. And then, you know, we break it down into, well, is it realistic? Make sure it's realistic, because if you set yourself a goal that isn't realistic, you're setting yourself up to kind of fail from the start. Is it kind of measurable? Again, going back to the sorts of things of, okay, well, how will I measure? Well, how will I know once I've achieved that goal? You know, and when do I want to achieve it by? So, you know, they're not just big things, they're just day-to-day stuff as well. If we can recognize what it is that we want to achieve and break down, well, what needs to happen for that to happen? It's one of my favorite lines. Well, what needs to happen for that to happen? You know, try and identify what things you need to do to create that and to make that goal. But it's important to make sure you know what that goal really is before you start it.
Yeah, I did a lot of, I have done a lot of like endurance kind of races and things, and there was one in particular, it was a long kayak race, kind of 125 mile thing, and I'd trained for it for about a year, but I'd constantly be be goal setting was one. The next thing we're going to talk about is visualization. And I every time it started getting tough, I used to visualize crossing the line, like literally in my head, constantly think about, let's get to that point. Let's get to that point. There's the visualization. Why or how can we incorporate visualization?
Visualization we can incorporate into every aspect of our day. Again, a little bit like the kind of the positive self-talk. Our brain actually sometimes struggles to differentiate between real life and imagined life, and it will have the same impact whether something is actually happening in the here and now or whether you play it out like a movie in your mind. So if we actually visualize something positive happening, what our brain doing is, to a certain degree, is actually kind of going through that experience. So if you visualize yourself achieving something, clearly that's going to result in positive hormones and chemicals being pumped around your body, which will make you feel more relaxed, makes you feel more confident, make you feel more calm. And actually you'll be more focused to be able to kind of tackle whatever it is that you want to do. So to a certain degree, it's, yes, it's made up, but it's not. Your brain can't differentiate between the two. So we know, and research shows us, that if we visualize something happening the way we want to it to happen before it's happening, there is a greater chance it will go that way. So we have a lot of research around that now.
Historically, you look at like Buddhism and their teachings, there was a lot of that around kind of you are what you think about. And it is powerful. You speak about calmness then. What is the importance of our next kind of subheading, which is a bit of green, a bit of nature?
Oh, a bit of green, a bit of nature. It really can't be underestimated. There's so much. Again, we have so much research now. It's not a bit fluffy. It's not just, oh, it's quite nice to get outside. There is so much research now around the positive impact on our ability to think clearly and be more focused and have elevated moods and decrease stress levels when we are outside. There are so many things that stimulate our, I'll come back again to this the soothing system. Being outside, if we are able to be in kind of presently in the moment, and that's one of the things to really practice when you go outside. Yes, we can be outside, but what we need to try and do is just engage in our surroundings so we are out of our head. And we are actually in the context that we are in, as in, outside, preferably in nature around us, because we know that this stimulates the hormones and the happy hormones associated with us being calm and relaxed and having a positive mood. And also, even just the very basics of being outside and getting more vitamin D, because sunlight, we know, produces more vitamin D, and that's all part and parcel of the process of our moods and creating positive moods. So I can't underestimate, and especially at the moment, sometimes, again, going back to the 15-minute rule, maybe we can't be bothered to go outside and go for a walk, but have the knowledge that it genuinely will contribute towards your psychological health.
It's very mindful as well. We've spoke about that on the podcast before, mindfulness and how that can help.
Yeah.
Something that can help, especially when you incorporate a lot of these topics, is problem solving. And that's next on our list. Why has that been included in this?
It's been included because sometimes it's problems. And actually, I suppose to start with, I like to kind of try to differentiate between hypothetical worries and real worries, because problem solving can help us when we are worrying about something. So a lot of the time we're thinking about stuff which I would call our hypothetical worries, the what ifs. And the what ifs are, what if this happens, what if that happens, and they tend to be things that are future focused and we actually can't do anything about. So the first step really is to try and understand whether a worry is something that we can actually impact. Or is it a hypothetical worry, a what if, that really there's nothing that we can do about it? So it's kind of futile, really, trying to think about it and worry about it, because we're not going to be able to problem solve it. So problem solving is helpful when we're feeling worried about something. If there's actually something genuinely that we can do about it, it enables us to actually focus on, you know, what part we can play in getting something done or achieving something that needs to happen, or, as I say, solving something that needs to be solved. But it is all about the process, is all about breaking it down. Again, with problems that need to be solved, a lot of the time we can keep them a bit too high level. But if we can actually break it down into the things that, what is the problem, for example, actually, you know, try and actually define what the problem is. And then the next part is, well, what can I actually do about it? What is my part in this? You know, what effects do I want to have? How can I best achieve it? What are the resources around me that I can use? So it really is about, again, almost what needs to happen for this to happen. But it just enables us to stop what I would call ruminating, going round and round and round something, and not coming up with a solution. If it is a problem that can be solved, i.e. it's not a hypothetical worry, actually breaking it down into steps enables us to understand the problem and actually tackle the problem in a much more clearer and better way.
I think it's this podcast actually is part of that. I couldn't control the bigger problems that we're facing at the moment, but I could do certain things to bring people together, to bring this body of work together. And now we're on the line talking about this.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. It was something I could do. It was something I could do. And again, I couldn't do the bigger picture stuff, but which kind of brings us on to self-compassion, really. And I could go on and on about this, but I'll leave it to you. This was something that David Wiseman first talked about with me a couple of years ago, and having self-compassion, why is it, again, so important?
I think it's very much a thing of us Westerners. We seem to have this perception that if we constantly give ourselves a kick up the backside, it means that we'll achieve something or we'll get done what needs to get done. And we kind of have fallen into this kind of understanding of, you know, beating ourselves up perhaps is the best way to get through things. What we know is that the only thing that does, self-criticism, as opposed to being self-compassionate and kind with ourselves, it throws fuel over that threat system, that fight or flight system. So again, if we come back to the point where we want those emotional systems to be nicely balanced, we want the soothing system to be on as much as possible to help counteract our threat system, our fight or flight system, one of the easiest ways to do this is to be self-compassionate and kind with ourselves, because we can start immediately. Now, one of the problems, or let's say one of the barriers with self-compassion, is that a lot of us might tend to see it as being weak, or we're letting ourselves get away with things, or that it would hinder our performance if we start being kind and compassionate with ourselves. But it is genuinely the complete opposite, because if you are able to calm your fight or flight system down and you ignite that soothing system through something like self-compassion, it helps us get through some of these speed bumps. It helps us be able to think more clearly. It helps us be able to calm that threat system down and to be able to tackle what it is that we're actually needing to tackle. Because I tell you, being self-critical, giving yourself a hard time, will literally have the opposite impact on you than you think it might do. Sometimes, yes, of course, it's motivating to you know, be a bit firm with ourselves and to try and motivate ourselves. But if it turns into self-criticism, all your brain hears is you being criticized and your threat system comes online. We have a very big negative bias in our brain. We are pre-programmed and pre-wired to pick up the negatives. And all that does, as I say, is stimulate the threat system. So we have to work a bit harder and a lot more consciously to override the negative bias, because the negative bias shouts really loudly, because it's designed as part of our part of our threat system and to keep us safe. So we have to be more active and we have to be more conscious about how critical we're being with ourselves, and consider how would that feel if I was, let's say, saying that to a friend or a family member or even to a child, you know, would it make them feel better or would it make them feel worse? Would it make them feel motivated or would it make them, you know, feel really bad about themselves? And you have to think about it in that way, because again, your brain can't differentiate the difference between you telling yourself something and somebody else telling yourself something.
If you look at self-compassion as well, especially at this time, you've got people at home, and let's say we spoke about it separately, but you look at parenting, you're trying to parent, you're trying to work, you're trying to deal with problems, you're trying to look after a household, actually giving yourself self-compassion during the day. And if you've got a big list of things to do, well, actually don't use self-compassion as a priority as well. Like if you need to do physical exercise in the morning because it makes you feel good, or if you need to go away and meditate, or if you need some breathing technique, or if you need to plan your day, then you should be doing that and not giving yourself a hard time. Mm-hmm. The last thing, and it seems strange really to talk about a social network, but the last thing is strengthen our social network.
I know. And it's, you know, we know in my field that your social support network is your biggest psychological protective factor. So the biggest thing to help protect your psychological health is having a good social support network. Now, you know, we are pre-programmed, we are pre-wired to be with people, to be part of something, of part of a group. It enables us to be able to talk things through with people. It gives us more resources to lean on. You know, it helps us with our emotional, even physical self and our psychological self. So we know that it is so, so important to keep up whatever level of social support network that you can. Obviously these days and in the time that we're in at the moment, everyone is being so creative in terms of what that looks like. You know, we have so many different platforms available for us to be able to keep in contact with people. And again, I know what it's like. There's sometimes for some, there's limited amount of time in the day, but to be able to ensure that we keep that engagement in different ways. You know, you see everybody doing fantastic choirs, you see lots of people doing quizzes online with their family, these sorts of things. You know, it's simple stuff, but we know it is the biggest protective psychological factor out of everything.
This also might be an opportunity for those that maybe feel isolated in kind of in brackets normal life to engage with a social community, whether that's on social media or whether that's a club that they may join later on, because there's a certain understanding of what people are going through at the moment.
I agree. It's a shared experience at the moment, and people should and if they can, they should tap into that, because I think there's so many different opportunities to join things at the moment and to be part of something.
Nessa, thank you very much, and we will leave it there.